British Public Radio. Nature.
Brought to you with the Nature Publishing Group.
This week, limousine or smart car. In the future, it'll drive itself.
Those working right on the cutting edge are saying that in 3 to 5 years, we're going to have cars that can go anywhere, anytime, on any roads without anybody in the vehicle driving it.
And a new way of making iron that could make it much more eco-friendly than it is now.
Overall, it contributes about 5% of the global amount of CO2 produced. And if you take steelmaking into account, it probably adds another 5%.
Plus the weirdly shaped atomic nuclei that might shake up the standard model of physics. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham. When German engineer Carl Benz invented the first automobile in the mid-1880s, little did he know how popular his design would become. Today, a billion people on the planet own a car. In fact, if you parked them all end to end, they'd wrap around the Earth 100 times. Cars afford us the freedom and luxury that public transport might not, but road transport as it is today is unsustainable. That's according to Lawrence Burns, Professor of Engineering Practice at the University of Michigan. Lawrence was Corporate Vice President of Research and Development at General Motors for 10 years, where he spent time thinking about how to reinvent our road transport system. In a comment piece this week, he describes a future of shared driverless vehicles, a vision that looks a bit like the world of the Jetsons. I called him to hear more.
The cars and trucks we drive today are pretty much the same as those 100 years ago. You know, they're powered by a combustion engine, energized by oil, driven by people, and used for a wide range of purposes. And what's happened is, because this automobile is so popular, unfortunately, there's some negative side effects. For example, over 1.2 million people a year are dying on the world's roadways. 95% of the energy for automobiles comes from oil, and whether it's geopolitical concerns that you might have or climate change, about one-fifth of the carbon dioxide that we're emitting on the planet comes from road transport. And then, quite honestly, our cities are becoming very, very congested, and moving around and finding a place to park is becoming difficult in a lot of major cities. It just suggests that the path we've been on for over a century is no longer sustainable and that we really need to come up with some new solutions.
What factors do you think have allowed our method of road transport to remain in place for so long?
First of all, it's a system. It's a system that involves vehicles and roads and convenient stations to refuel. And very importantly, it involves strong vested interests and business models that have become ingrained. And the good news now is it looks like a series of technologies and business models are beginning to come together that suggest road transportation is now ripe for transformation.
You spent the last 15 years thinking about this transformation. If you could reinvent the car, what would it be like?
Well, it would be safe, certainly would not crash. It would be very, very responsive and spontaneous. And when you do request a ride with this form of transportation, it has to be there immediately. The vehicle would be tailored to the purpose of the trip. Very, very importantly, I see us not having to park these vehicles. One of the biggest challenges for the automobile in cities is finding a place to park. So I see a mode of transportation where we would be sharing the vehicles. When I was at General Motors, I concluded, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, that driving was the distraction. Why else would somebody drive a 3,000 to 4,000-pound machine at 100 kilometers per hour and send a text message unless they thought that text was more important to send at that time than to drive safely? The idea then was, well, let's give consumers what they want. Let's see if we can eliminate the need for them to be tethered to the steering wheel and have to drive the car. Could we come up with driverless vehicles?
Now, I don't think I'd be alone in saying that I'd be anxious about getting in a driverless vehicle. What will the motor industry need to do to convince people that this is a good idea?
What we have to do is find a place to try this vision out as a complete system. if we said, well, we're just going to try out the electric vehicle part of this, hey, that's fine. That's happening right now. There's a lot of electric vehicles on the market today, and people are learning from them. But that they're not integrated into a necessarily a shared, coordinated driverless vehicle system. So it's really this focus on the total system. We have to find a place to try that out. Now, you want to do that in a risk-managed way. People then have to see the data. The regulators are going to have to see the data that, yes, indeed, under many of these conditions or all of these conditions, this car driving itself is safer than a person driving the car.
And what else might we need to put in place to make this network of shared driverless cars a reality?
We have shared vehicle businesses. We have connectivity. We have the ability to coordinate the flows of people and goods. We also provide traffic reports to help people pick the most least congested road to travel. So it's not like all these things need to be invented. The one piece that's coming together, the last piece of the puzzle that really is going to make this thing tip, is the driverless vehicles. A number of companies are working on these vehicles. Google, General Motors, Daimler, Toyota, and these companies are all putting the technology together, and those working right on the cutting edge are saying that in 3 to 5 years, we're going to have cars that can go anywhere, anytime, on any roads without anybody in the vehicle driving it.
That was Lawrence Burns.
Coming up, how to make iron using electricity instead of giant furnaces. But now it's time for the research highlights, bringing you the best from outside nature. Here's Charlotte Stoddart.
When a bullet shoots through a window, it leaves behind more than a hole. The hole is surrounded by cracks, and a bit of mathematics can turn those cracks into clues. Researchers in France used high-speed cameras to watch bullets shatter sheets of glass and plastic. Then they developed equations that use the number of cracks to show how fast the bullet was going or how brittle the material is. These equations could help detectives reconstruct crimes and accidents, and also help astronomers study craters on far-off planets. You can read more at Physical Review Letters. When commercial beekeepers collect honey from beehives, they often replace it with substitutes like sugar water for the bees to feed on. But that might take away essential nutrients, possibly contributing to the decline of bee colonies. Researchers at the University of Illinois identified substances from honey that turn on bee genes. Bees fed a diet of sugar water with a honey compound added versus those on sugar water alone had higher activity in genes that detoxify pesticides and fight off germs. Read more in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Extracting iron from its naturally found form, iron oxide, is a hot and heavy business. You throw your iron oxide and some carbon into a blast furnace and then heat it to 1,600 degrees Celsius. Out comes iron, worldwide about 1 billion tons of it a year. But also out comes carbon dioxide, bad news for the environment. Scientists would like to use other friendlier methods to make iron. This week, a team from MIT report a way to convert iron oxide to iron using electricity. It's not a new idea. It's basically a form of electrolysis, which extracts the oxygen, leaving pure iron behind. But they've gotten over the biggest problem, finding materials that can withstand the temperatures of molten metal oxides. Metallurgist Derek Frey at the University of Cambridge in the UK has written a News and Views article about the research. He started by telling me how much CO2 iron production is responsible for.
Overall, it contributes about 5% of the global amount of CO2 produced. And if you take steelmaking into account, it probably adds another 5%.
So it's a pretty chunky percentage.
It is.
And what's the standard procedure then for producing iron?
Well, iron ore is dug out of the ground, and it's usually put into a blast furnace with carbon. And what happens is the carbon reacts with some air, which is injected into the bottom to form CO, and then that reduces the iron oxide to iron, liquid iron. It operates about 1600 degrees centigrade.
And how about the approach that this paper by Sadoway and colleagues details?
Well, essentially, if the electricity is got from a green renewable source, it essentially eliminates the production of carbon dioxide, because essentially you just take the iron oxide, produce iron on the cathode and oxygen on the anode. And the problem up to now has been that nobody has actually discovered an anode which will survive at very high temperatures in a molten electrolyte which contains oxides.
I think people will probably remember from their high school science days what these are, but would you just give me kind of a brief description of electrolysis and then how it relates to this new finding?
Yes, the iron oxide is dissolved in the electrolyte and it forms iron ions, Fe3+, Fe2+. And when they approach the cathode where the electrons are, the electrons essentially get added to the Fe2+ or Fe3+ and cancels out the charges and you produce iron.
And can you take us through just what this looks like then? You've got an anode and a cathode sort of sticking into, you know, this liquid metal, have you?
The simplest system would be a metal pool, the iron pool. Then you would have a layer of the electrolyte. And on top of that, there would be the anode where the oxygen evolved and it can escape into the environment or be collected. It might be a valuable commodity.
So what have they done here? What's the new breakthrough?
They've found a chromium iron alloy, which when placed in the melt, it essentially forms a protective oxide layer, which seems not to dissolve into the electrolyte.
But is it feasible? I mean, industrially scaled up?
That is a big question, because in an iron blast furnace, essentially the reactions take place in three dimensions. So you've got this gas flowing past the particles, and they get reduced all over the surface. The description of the process is that you have a liquid pool, and that's essentially two-dimensional. So that the amount of material produced per square metre is much less. So there are lots of challenges.
Still a long way off, perhaps, being able to be applied.
Oh, I would think so. I think in the field of metallurgical processing, it usually takes about 20 years between somebody inventing something and it putting it into production.
As a byproduct of this process, obviously you're generating oxygen. I mean, what circumstances could that be useful in?
Well, one of the problems with space exploration is that the rockets run on hydrogen and oxygen. The Saturn rocket that took the astronauts to the moon 20, 30 years ago, whenever it was, that rocket consisted of 85 tonnes of oxygen and about 5 tonnes of hydrogen and the rest was the structure of the rocket. So you have to have enough oxygen to get you to the moon and to get you back again. And the goal, perhaps a dream, was that they could use the moon as a launch pad for the rest of the solar system because the gravity is so much less on the moon, you need less propulsion to leave the gravitational field.
Soon to come, the news chat. First, though, Adam Rutherford gets all bent out of shape with some odd atomic nuclei.
Everyone knows what an atom looks like, right? A small, round bunch of balls with electrons circling them. The balls in question are the nucleus made of protons and neutrons, collectively known as nucleons. They're held together by the so-called strong nuclear force via particles known as gluons, all nice and symmetrical. Except that that symmetry, that perfect sphere, is an idealised description. Going up the periodic table, as the number of nucleons increases, the atoms get bigger, and this simple model of the atomic nucleus goes a bit pear-shaped, as Peter Butler, Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Liverpool, explains.
The problem is that in trying to take this description further, in order to try to predict how a nucleus behaves, is that because there are, particularly for heavier nuclei, there are many such nucleons which interact with each other, that it rapidly becomes impossible to make a simple description of how the nucleus may behave. So what one has to do is use what are called effective interactions, which essentially make averages over the behaviour of the nucleons within the nuclear field. And this can be used by adjusting the parameters which describe this interaction to try to predict the overall behaviour of nuclei.
So by looking at interactions between the protons and neutrons, we can predict how it affects the shape of the nucleus.
The interactions tend to make the nucleus distorted, and in general that will make the nucleus assume the shape of a rugby ball, or if you prefer, an American football. And that is the most common shape of atomic nuclei, as it turns out.
That rugby ball shape is more properly known as a quadrupole deformation, but physicists think that certain heavy, unstable atoms have an even stranger shape, an octopole deformation, better known as pear-shaped. Peter Butler has seen this pear shape for the first time in exotic and highly unstable atoms of radon and radium.
What we essentially did is to measure the electric charge distribution in the nucleus. One of the best ways of determining the shape of nuclei is to look at how the charge, which is carried by the protons, distributes itself throughout the nucleus. Now, what we've done is taken that a step further, whereby if we go beyond electric quadrupole shapes or charge distributions in the nuclei, then what we see is that if you've got a pear shape, then that would give the nucleus a higher order charge distribution through the nucleus, and that's actually called an electric octopole moment. So what we've done is to measure directly what this electric octopole moment is, what the value is, and how it behaves as we rotate the nucleus system. And from that, we can infer directly that the nucleus, or the particular nucleus that we looked at, in fact, assume this pear shape, this rather asymmetric shape.
To make the measurements, the team used particle accelerators at CERN to speed the atoms up to 10% of the speed of light.
This has only been possible in the last few years, and the reason is because, first of all, there is a facility at CERN called Isolde, which are methods to actually isolate a particular radioisotope of interest. The next step is to take these short-lived isotopes, which are produced in large quantities, and then accelerate them to energies where you can actually do nuclear reaction experiments. And that's what we've been able to do in order to carry out these measurements.
So, big, exotic atoms can have big bottoms. How does this fit into the all-important Standard Model, the set of rules that describe the behaviours of all subatomic particles and their antimatter partners? Peter Butler's results are a big step forward in filling in some gaps in the Standard Model.
One of the motivations for our work was, in fact, to take account of the fact that what has not been explained as far as how the universe ticks is why there is an inequality between the amount of matter and antimatter in the universe. I mean, if the quantities were exactly the same, then everything would annihilate. We wouldn't be doing this interview now. But now it turns out that the same forces that could produce enough matter would also subtly change the shape of atoms, actually. And they would push the electrons of the atom one way or the other along the axis of spin. And that would give rise to what's called an electric dipole moment in the atoms, or an EDM. In fact, the Standard Model of particle physics predicts that the value of the electric dipole moment in atoms is so small that it should lie below the current observational limit. However, of course, many theoreticians are trying to refine the model, and a lot of these theories predict EDMs that should be measurable. So clearly to test these theories, searches for EDMs have to be improved. And one of the potential improvements is to use exotic atoms whose nuclei are pear-shaped. Because if you do that, then there's an enhancement of the measurable EDM by up to a factor of 1,000. Of course, if something is seen, then this has to be quantified, and our measurements will help to do that. It would enable any result to be properly interpreted.
That was Peter Butler talking to Adam Rutherford.
Nearly the end of the show, and on the line from Washington, D.C. is our US news editor, Eric Hand. Hi, Eric.
How are you, Kerry?
Very well. Now, our first story goes back to this budget request that Richard Van Norden told us about a month ago. One of the departments that did quite well out of this was the nuclear weapons complex, right?
That's right. The Department of Energy Weapons Labs seem to be getting yet another boost to pursue some modifications for one of their tried and true nuclear weapons, the B-61 bomb.
Which is surprising given that the states are, I suppose, not supposed to be making any new nuclear bombs.
That's right. And so it's a question of what constitutes a new bomb. The weapons complex say that by merging components from different types of bombs into this modified bomb, it's actually allowing them to cut the stockpile down even further in future agreements with Russia. Critics, though, say that by making it a smaller, more accurate bomb with a lower yield, it might actually lead to this bomb being deployed more readily in places like Europe.
So there are the ethical concerns, but financial concerns as well, or at least financial queries as to why a department with a much smaller stockpile of nuclear bombs now than ever, you know, would need any more money.
That's right. Recently, a Democratic Senator, Dianne Feinstein, remarked that we're spending as much now on the weapons program as we were at the end of the Cold War, even though the number of weapons that the U.S. labs maintain has dropped from about 20,000 down to about 1,500.
So what gives? What's the reason behind all of this, financial upkeep?
Well, one theory, and there are many, is that it's important to maintain a robust weapons program and to give fancy machines and facilities to the very smart physicists who design these weapons, and that, in a way, you need to have this as a jobs program in order to keep them interested and a part of the complex.
And what have others in the scientific community been saying that nature has spoken to this week?
Well, there's plenty of nuclear watchdogs in the D.C. area that are quite annoyed that the levels of spending go on like this.
Okay, moving on. This is about a paper from Nature in 2005 that looked at dance. Tell us first of all about this paper.
That's right. In 2005, some researchers found that Jamaican dancers, that there was a degree of correlation between the dancers' body symmetry and how they were rated in terms of their dancing skill. And so this in turn suggested that dancing might be subject to sexual selection, since many biologists have studied how different species are attracted to body symmetry as a true signal for underlying genetic fitness. And so this study in turn suggested that maybe dancing could be a true signal and something that could be subject to sexual selection.
It's going to make me look at dancers in a whole new light, I have to say. But so this is an old paper. This is from the lab of the biologist Robert Trivers.
That's correct. An evolutionary biologist at Rutgers University. But soon after he published it, a couple years later, he began to suspect that some of the data had been faked, and he's been on a campaign to have the paper retracted ever since.
Now, this week, Rutgers University give us their take on this paper and the supposedly faked data. What do they say?
That's right. Last month, Rutgers published their investigation, and they found that, yes, in fact, there was evidence of fakery in the underlying data, and that Robert Trivers' allegations against one of his former postdoctoral researchers were vindicated. And yet, the paper still remains unretracted.
So what's next then? I mean, this is what Robert Trivers has been saying all along. I suppose he must be very happy that, at least Rutgers agree with him.
That's right. He says he's not going to replicate the study, but he does continue to do work in Jamaica, measuring symmetry on people and trying to correlate those measurements to various fitness signals. His latest study that he says he's about to submit correlates symmetry to running ability rather than dancing.
And how about the publishers of the paper? Are Nature going to retract this after all?
So far, Nature, the manuscript editors have not commented other than to say that the paper is under active consideration.
So I suppose the conflict still goes on then?
To a certain extent, I think that though the university investigation should be enough to lay this paper to rest, even though the paper nonetheless spurred a whole lot of interest in a field where there still may be some room to go, even though this particular paper may turn out to be a fraud, there is evidence that there could be a small correlation or a weak correlation between body symmetry and dancing skill.
Eric Han there, thank you for that update. More at nature.com/news. Next week, where our Neanderthal cousins a dab hand at painting. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham.